Hello, welcome to Transistor Radio, where we have a chip chat about semiconductors. I'm Doug, and this is
I'm Dylan.
this is Dylan. Yeah, we're here to talk about a little different than our normal analysis, but I think we're going to talk about a little bit of geopolitics, maybe a little bit about the economy, but mostly about the decoupling of East-West and regionalization of semiconductors. So yeah, without further ado, I think we wanted to start on xenon and neon gas, because we've been seeing in the media like really get hyped up about this fear, like, oh, there's gonna be another semiconductor shortage. And at least everything that Dylan and I have read, it does not seem to be the case. Dylan, you want to start with your spiel?
Yes, sure. So, you know, the simple overview is, hey, about 50% of neon gas is produced in Ukraine and Russia. And, you know, oh my God, the Ukrainian ones have already shut down, and we've cut off Russia completely from the Western, you know, or semiconductor economies for that matter, right? Japan and Taiwan, as well as the Western economies. So, oh my God, neon, semiconductors are all not going to be able to be manufactured. But actually, calm down, guys. So you've seen a lot of articles where people have, you've probably seen a lot of articles where people are freaking out. I was in Nikkei, Asia, telling people it's not as great, you know, as scary as it may seem. And part of that is because, hey, there's actually more supply than you think. So there's 6 months of supply in the supply chain, roughly at the actual fabs, another 2 to 3 months at some distributors. And then you look at what happened last time there was Ukraine, Russian, you know, fears or issues. There was a project put on by Trump in order to make laser recycling, lasers able to recycle the neon that they use. The lasers I'm specifically referring to are in ARF, argon fluoride, and KRF lithography, which is used in every semiconductor process, right? So it's you know, you can recycle this laser, and you can roughly double the amount of neon that you want to use. And it's costly, but, you know, neon is not even a basis point of cost on semiconductor manufacturing. So who cares? And then furthermore, right, this neon is not used continuously, right? It's used to start up the laser. So there's some interesting tricks you can do, which would effectively, you know, double the amount of neon supply you have once you implement them. So you're talking about going from 3 months, I mean, six months plus 3 months to, you know, 12 months plus 6 months. And then you talk about how it's only half of the supply. So you're still getting deliveries. Not as worried. I'm not as worried. And then, you know, Doug, you want to talk about new production or?
Yeah. So the part that I was, I looked at was, so Ukraine, the reason why there's such a big neon and base there is because they're one of the largest steel manufacturers in the world. And so steel, like especially extremely heavy industry, relies on these air separator units done by the likes of Air Products and Lind and all the other big air separator unit companies. And so I believe it was just like some level of willingness to be a little less environmentally friendly. And this is something that can be upgraded. So the air separator units can probably, if you have a large air separator unit, you can have some incremental CapEx to then be able to have more neon out of it. And that doesn't seem like, that seems like it's very reactive and able to be quickly added to the capacity within a, you know, we have 12 months now, right? We're already seeing CapEx projects in Japan for air separating units now, specifically focused on semiconductor projects. So I feel like this is something that we, the companies are, you know, not dumb about, and they're going to start to be able to sell neon gas at a huge markup because of the problem. So the basis point of cost between adding new capacity and upgrading current air separating units, like this is a non-issue in my opinion.
Yeah. And then just one more thing on that is a lot of neon is produced at non-Ukrainian, you know, steel manufacturers without it being quite as pure as semiconductors need. But you're able to sort of level that up by taking the non-semiconductor grade and then purifying it further, which can then be done, you know, at a separate facility. That could actually be a steel manufacturer that upgraded their unit. So, and then, you know, I think you talked a little bit about China, and their things related to, steel. So maybe you could touch on that as well.
Well, China actually ramped neon production meaningfully at some point, but then decided to shut it down because of the environmental impact of it, because this is obviously a very heavy industry output. And so they took tons of market share, and then they forcibly decided, hey, we don't want to, like, we're not going to participate in this market. They have the manufacturing footprint to do that right now. So this is a place where the economy can be reactive and make a lot of money really quickly just by being able to ramp this up. So this, I don't know if it's quite happening yet, but there's like any rational economic actor would be ramping right now. So I'm not really concerned, because that's like yet another way to alleviate the supply crisis. So I think that the problem here, and like, I actually wanted to write about it when I first saw it, but then when I did some more research, I was like, oh, this is a nothing burger. And then of course, like, you know, most of media is like, oh my God, neon outage. But if you really think about it, like, no, this is thinking about it backwards, where it's like, oh, Ukraine happened to have a lot of neon because they're a huge steel production. And then neon is used in semiconductors. Oh my God, there's going to be a shortage. And it's like, no, it's a little bit more complicated than that. And people are just really excited to write up another, hey, there's another shortage headline. And I think it's nothing. So
the fun thing is, I remember pinging you in like early January. I'm like, yo, Doug, what is this stuff? Like, you should write about it. And you're like, you spend like a day, and then you come back and you're like, oh, it's not really a big deal. I kind of wish you did. You would have seemed like a genius.
Yeah, it would have done some numbers, right? Like, I remember I actually even tweeted about it, like, oh my God, I'm gonna have to learn about, you know, some random gas in Ukraine. And, you know, I did some work, and I was like, it just doesn't seem quite like a problem. So, but I mean, we'll see. I really think that all these ways to reduce the supply shortage is going to totally kick in. So no real problem there. But I do think that this highlights one of the continuous problems with the entire semiconductor industry, is that things are localized, right? Like, it's a global economy. And then there's like very intense manufacturing bases that are extremely, extremely localized with extremely high market share. Obviously, the one that comes to top of mind is Taiwan. Everyone knows that, right? They make most of the advanced chips. Like, what's 50% of share by TSMC, add UMC and PMC, then we're probably talking 60% of global market share in foundry. So like, huge manufacturing base there. But, you know, lithography is in the Netherlands, right? Netherlands? Yeah, it's in the Netherlands.
Yeah, and then, you know, lithography is also in Japan, right? You think about all mass production, mass blanks. I mean, most of that is there. All the photoresist, all the coders and developers, right? You know, so to putting the photoresist on the wafer, right? So all these things, you know, if Netherlands is gone or Japan is gone, there is no lithography and there is no semiconductors. But then there's more, right? There's like random etching gases in South Korea, and like metrology from Israel, and there's so many individual pieces that we just don't know. Well, we do, you know, if you do enough digging, you could figure some out. But turns out, hey, there's you know, semiconductor processes are over 1,000 steps, and each of those 1,000 steps takes a certain tool and chemical inputs. Oh my God, this is ridiculous.
Yeah, it gets really intense super quickly. I actually have a historical example, is that there was an epoxy used for packaging back in the day in like 1980 something. And one factory in Japan blew up with 60% of the world supply, and everyone freaked the fuck out. Like, and I think that... And what happened was, everyone's like, oh my God, we only have a 3-month supply, and this was the only factory. And actually, they managed to work around that, where it didn't become as big of a deal but that's like a perfect example where there is probably some chemical factory making some specialty chemical with 85% market share that is used for one process in making a semiconductor, that it's a, you know, one of two. And that probably doesn't happen, like, that probably happens tens of times, right? Like, there's something, there is a link in the global supply chain that could break. So this is just part of the extremely complex part of making a semiconductor. Like, it just is not that easy. It takes a whole village. Everything is needed and important. So, so we have all these local manufacturing bases and like extremely specialized products, like, but with the geopolitical environment, you know, after seeing Ukraine, and like, you know, now we're talking Russia, US, and China is all over the place, and we're not going to have any like real takes on that. But it's very clear that every country wants to localize their own supply. Because
I don't know, Doug. I don't know if the U.S. wants to, given they still haven't passed the CHIPS Act.
Dude, oh man, I feel like that's just bait for me to get angry about the CHIPS Act. Because I'm fucking furious. Like what's really funny is, yeah, sure, we think we want to, but like we were told. So Dylan and I went to SemiCon, and you know, the sponsor of the bill was like, oh, it's any week now. It's March. It's like the middle of March right now, guys. Like, I know the bill is like kind of passed, but it's just not funded. Like, let's hurry this up. Like, I don't really like, this is ridiculous. I think the EU might tie us, right?
The worst part is I'm pretty sure we started talking about this when Trump was president with the FABS Act in like 2019, 2020. And yet here we are in 2022 and Japan has passed theirs. The EU is probably gonna, you know, tie us in terms of when they pass theirs. And you know, it's just, you know, so sad.
Yeah, and I'm pretty sure like even Korea got some like incremental spending in. Like it just,
oh, and the new president is freaking like semi-cap bull. Like,
oh yeah.
He loves, you know, he's on the conservative side from my understanding. And he is on the industry side, from my understanding. And yeah. Samsung's new, you know, head getting out of jail maybe 6 to 8 to 9 months ago. Plus this guy, they're gonna do like you know, a fusion hot in like semiconductor spending.
I'm pretty excited for that. I mean, Samsung is obviously, I would say, probably the biggest challenge foundry in the world, right? Like Intel is. I mean, like Intel's foundry doesn't really exist until 2024. And like, you know, Tower obviously is a kickstart, but like Intel making leading edge chips for other companies, that just doesn't really exist yet. I would love to see it, but like they first have to ramp all their own internal processes and then IFS can learn. Samsung is the company with the foundry, with the capacity, and probably with the aggression. And if the government is willing to just kick them a few tens of billions of dollars, I think they could really do some damage there. Samsung is the company that is probably the least transparent about their spending plans. So I'm excited about that. But obviously one of the more important parts is like Intel is the West's hedge, Europe and US. So do you want to talk about that a little bit, Dylan? Like the recent Intel EU fab announcement, and then just like, how credible do you think in Pat's conversation about Intel being a hedge against geopolitical tension? I'm really buying it more, but I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Yeah. So, you know, Pat has said multiple times, like, hey, Intel is the geopolitical hedge against instability. Right. And what he means is that, you know, this is a semiconductor supply chain, right, that is not just based in Taiwan and South Korea and, you know, Singapore. It's based elsewhere. Of course, Intel does have, you know, a lot of semiconductor, you know, supply chain issues, you know, like something like 60-70% of their test and packaging is done in China currently. But you know, we can ignore that and, you know, talk about where they're spending, right? Which is completely different from where everyone else is spending, right? You know, right now, huge amounts of money in Arizona and Ireland, right? Ireland's going to get another like $12 billion of spending. Arizona's going to have another 20 to 30, and this is all production that's going to ramp in, you know, 23, 24. And then Ohio, you know, they've got the massive announcement there, and that's going to start production in 25-ish. And then they're 25-ish and 26, really. And then you've got the European announcements where they're like, hey, we're going to have a new R&D center in France. We're going to do a supercomputer in Spain. We're going to do potentially a packaging, advanced packaging plant in Italy. And then most importantly, I guess, would be the Silicon Junction in Germany, where they're going to spend, you know, what is it, like 20 billion euros or so on, you know, two fabs there. I don't remember the exact number. Sorry.
I think it's 17, 12 in Ireland, and oh no, 12 in Italy, and then just like ongoing amounts in Ireland. I think I did some, but yeah, you're directly correct here on all the numbers.
But yeah, that one is in 2027. So you know, they're building capacity where, you know, Where is TSMC's, you know, 3-nanometer fab? Well, that's in freaking Taiwan. And where is, you know, Samsung's 3-nanometer fab? Well, that's in South Korea.
Yeah, so I really do buy it. I just think it's such a hard battle for them. I'm really excited. I will say that as a Western citizen, I'm pretty stoked. Like we need this. So Intel's doing the right things. And then I guess, do you want to talk about the economy last? Like kind of the most contentious parts, because I feel like between the last time we talked and now, things have changed meaningfully on the ground. Obviously, Ukraine is a part of that and spiking oil prices. But there's just like a fear and insecurity in the global economy that we haven't seen in a long time, partially driven by COVID in Shenzhen. Do you have you ever like any information there?
Yeah. So Shenzhen and COVID in China is, you know, spiking, I think, potentially more than has ever spiked since the actual 2020 outbreak, at least, you know, from the news flow. So, you know, this is a very big spike, and the way, you know, China has reaffirmed that they're still on the zero COVID policy. And so that's meant that, you know, Shenzhen shut down and Shanghai shut down, and, you know, there's shutdowns in a lot of other random, you know, cities. And it's like, oh, holy crap. Like Foxconn does a crap load of production there. And so does everyone else. Right. And so there's, I think there's a meaningful chance that, you know, if these shutdowns are 2 weeks, 3 weeks, whatever, production has stopped at many factories, right? Some of them know, like for example, you know, fabs themselves are not being shut down, which is great. You know, and we even saw that in 2020 in Wuhan when Yangtze Memory was not shut down when they were, you know, when Wuhan went into like mega lockdown. So, you know, the fabs aren't being shut down, but there's so much more. Right, OSATs are completely being shut down, or some of them are, and then assembly, especially, right, actually putting the chip in the device, that's being shut down. So there's a meaningful chance that a lot of production is missed, and, you know, it sort of exacerbates shortages, and therefore, you know, the, you know, elasticity or whatever of semiconductor devices, right, consumer spend, right, the prices are just going to go up a little bit more, right. And then you turn around and say, okay, well, you know, this geopolitical stuff, you know, whatever this commodity cycle does, they're meaningfully up, right? We're talking, you know, spending for your average Indian or Chinese citizen is way up. And obviously American citizens as well. And, you know, people all around the world, Japan, South Korea, but at least those folks can more easily digest the impact of energy costs. But, you know, European energy costs soaring, especially on electricity, natural gas. You know, you look at Indian and Chinese economies where the people, you know, a lot of their spending in Africa, right, where a lot of their spending is actually, you know, energy and commodities, like metals and stuff like that. Their consumer wallet is being hurt really badly. And so I think a week ago, maybe 2 weeks ago, I was like, guys, I'm kind of worried about semiconductors because, well, at the end of the day, you know, most of semiconductor spending is still consumer driven, and Doug will talk about the bull case, and I'm still with him there on the non-consumer stuff. But on the consumer spending case, right, it's PC and it's smartphone. So smartphone being the bigger, right, smartphone is something like 40% of total semiconductor spending. That's meaningfully slowing, and we're already seeing some data points, right? Like I talked to someone who works at Xiaomi, pretty high up, and they were like, yeah, they're slowing down massively. You know, that's just one company, but that's also what, second largest smartphone manufacturer. Yeah. And it's a small sample size. I agree. You know, PC units
have a large sample size, like more than enough to be significant. Like if what they're seeing in the market, they're either losing all the share right now, or so it's an either or there. And I think almost always, given the context, the latter is probably the correct answer, that rather what's happening is the economy is slowing down. But we're going to see, I think it's really complicated, right? Like the consumer side of things, like, you know, you're talking about inflation getting meaningfully higher for energy costs. And I guess the fear is we went from literally the fear of a deflationary economy into a stagflationary economy in almost like 2 years, where what the biggest fear is that wage growth will not outgrow inflation. And especially given energy right now, that looks possible. But if energy continues to slow down, maybe there's a chance. But all these things are uncertainties in the global economy. And those global economy uncertainties, you know, trickle through to business spending, right? Businesses will be like, maybe we're a little less certain to spend too. And that can impact the non-consumer side of things. Like, I don't really know the answer. I don't think anyone does. Like, macro is really, really hard, but all these things are incrementally weakening to the global economy. And the thing that I always try to pull back and like not forget is semiconductors historically grow about 1.5 times the global GDP, nominal GDP. So the problem is 1.5 times to the upside, that's great. 1.5 times to the downside, that's terrible. And that's usually what happens. Where, so if you think there's a recession, which I don't, but I think that there's legitimate fears of a recession right now, then you can understand why investors are so scared about semiconductors. And
you know, the thing about that 1.5x comment is, you know, I think we made the comment on one of our previous podcasts, right? And we both talked about it many times. It's like, hey, you know, that 1.5x is actually now like 2x because of all the buzzword soup. And you think about like Maslow's hierarchy of needs or something, some framework of, you know, framing consumer spending. It's like, yeah, if I'm now spending, you know, 50% more on energy and commodities, and that was already, you know, a large portion of my spending, I'm totally not going to go out there and buy a new smartphone, you know, 2 years or 3 years in. I'm going to hold it a little bit longer. Or a PC, right? I'm not going to upgrade my, you know, 2015 PC. I'll hold it a little bit longer. Cause holy crap, you know, I've got all these other things to worry about.
Yeah. Actually, the perfect example that I think of is the smartphone average length of life is kind of similar to what happened to cars pre 2020. So what happened was cars got a lot better. Like, as you know, if you have a 2010 car, it's probably still in use. And so what happened was the average age of cars really lengthened. Like, it went from like 5 years was the average age, and this is just in the United States, to like 11 years. And so I don't think a phone can last 11 years, to be quite frank with you. But in, let's say, 2010, the average age of phone was probably like 2 years, 1.5 or something. People were constantly upgrading every cycle. And if you have less incentive to, and because you're being squeezed a little bit, you're going to slow down that pace, and the average age of phones will lengthen. And so that means each year people buy less phones, and that relationship will eventually top out. But right now it's been lengthening, and it could definitely lengthen longer. And
the whole PC area, right? Like, you know, it went through that same exact, you know, cycle where, yes, it was like, oh, PCs are good enough, PCs are lengthening, right? You know, and then all of a sudden COVID happens, and there's all this pent up, you know, sort of demand where, you know, people were like, oh wait, my PC isn't actually as good as, you know, it's for what I need to do now, right? I need to sit and use it every day for 10 hours, and I can't go outside, so actually let me add 4 more hours onto that or whatever. And the cycle, you know, really shortened. And then you had, you know, 350 million sales in 2021, and, you know, a lot of sales in 2020 as well. And people are saying 350 million PC sales in 22. But, you know, there's a meaningful chance that that doesn't happen given, you know, all these other issues related to the consumer.
Yeah, 100%. I agree with that. I like, for example, that lengthening contracted meaningfully, but it probably is going to go back to that previous demand function. So we just don't know. And then all this economic uncertainty is for real. But the thing I always want to remind people is that fears about the global economy and going into recession happen pretty frequently, at least in my very short stint in markets. I remember it in 2018, we were convinced that we were in a shadow recession. Or, for example, I think in late 2015, all of the industrial and non-consumer side of the economy in the United States was in a recession while consumer was not. And everyone's like, oh my God, this is going to flow through. It's not uncommon to have these fears in macro for the economy. Like, that's just how it works. The market is very forward-looking, and very, very small things will change the sensitivity in the future to be discounted into the present value now. So the difference, though, is that like 9 times out of 10, what happens is people get really baked into this like fear or recession or whatever is going to happen, and the fears start to become bigger in their head than in reality. Like, this happens in your personal life all the time. Let's say you're like really concerned about some big XYZ event. You go do it and you're like, oh, that really wasn't as bad as I thought. And that kind of that like simple relationship definitely happens in the economy all the time. And so like before you're ready to call it like, oh my God, the consumer is screwed. You know, all this geopolitics is like absolutely screwed. There's a war in Ukraine. It's obvious that we're going to go into a ginormous recession now. Those fears are very similar to things that have happened in the past. I remember in 2011, there was a lot of legitimate fear at the time that there was going to be a double dip recession. Things happen, but the like over a long period of time, on average, you want to just like bet that things will continue to get better because they have, and they usually will. But it's very like, you know, I feel like it's very contrarian because it's always very sexy to sound super bearish because you sound very smart, in my opinion. So. Those are like the mitigating factors, but you know, to be clear, I'm very concerned about the global economy, and maybe you should be too. But no one is going to know until we actually see the results. So, yeah, that's my whole spiel. That's like, you know, the investing macro stuff from my previous life, I guess.
And before we end the podcast, I was going to go on a spiel, but is there anything else you wanted to talk about?
No, I think that's it for on my end, man.
Okay, well, I'm going to go into a pretty long rant about this, but pass the CHIPS Act.
Oh,
I think you should just cut the podcast there.
Yeah. Okay. You should rant about it, and I will add on because, like, what the hell are we doing? Dylan, you go first.
Okay, fair. I wanted to do a funny gag, but yeah, let's actually get angry. Start pounding tables and jumping on them and whatever it is. Yes, semiconductors are the high technology that build everything. And the U.S. has meaningfully lost lots of share. It used to be a global leader, and Europe as well, right? And now, you know, that's not happening. European companies continue to announce their, you know, most advanced silicon carbide fabs in non-Europe, right? You know, American companies are, you know, like Micron still continue to build their new memory production in Singapore and Taiwan, right? And you know, and the list could go on and on. You know, all this virtue signaling about semiconductor spending, you know, being regionalized, it's not really being done by anyone besides Intel, that is, right? You know, even GlobalFoundries, right, is like, hey, we're also Western based. No, all of your production, you know, more than half your production is in Singapore. Sorry, guys, and you're expanding that one the most currently, right? So it's like, no, the economies, you know, the incentives are just not there in the West, whereas other countries have them baked into law. And long term, you know, visibility onto what they are, right? Taiwan does, South Korea does, Singapore does, Japan now does, right? Everyone has this, except for the West. And the Western, you know, politicians need to stop, you know, worrying about whatever, you know, little thing like changing or removing daylight savings time, right? And instead, freaking focus on something that actually matters. And without, you know, the Western economies do not have a technology lead, and therefore will not be richer, right, than other economies, right? If their goal is to keep, you know, Western economies richer than the rest of the world, then they need to incentivize semiconductors.
Yeah, agreed. It's ridiculous at this point. I think the things that really, really, really irk me, man, and like I'm pretty passionate about this now too. Look, we might be entering a period of geopolitical destabilization. I don't know, but it definitely seems like the vibe right now. Ukraine, Russia, decoupling, whatever. Something that is really important, and we're going to continuously see this, is that having your own supply is going to really matter from a nation state perspective. This is something that happened in the past too. Like you can look at, you know, and I'm not gonna, like, World War II maybe not be the best example, but like Japan, the entirety of World War II was essentially struggling, crying for oil. Like they were always out of oil. And if semiconductors are the new oil, which is like a very popular meme, you need to control your own semiconductor supply. Like it's like a nice to have. It is a must have. Everything in this economy and digital world we live in is run on semiconductors. You have to have it. And it's just so ridiculous that how much of it is in Taiwan. And if you want to be able to, like, you know, secure your own, you know, nation, you need to have this, like for weapons, for like the cost of like just living, you know, everything that we use to communicate with each other. Like I cannot express like
medical technology.
Yeah, medical technology, right? Like the fact that we're cutting Russia off from the global economy, and you're seeing how ridiculously bad it is. And it's not because like, you know, we are sending them less stuff. We are doing less trade, but we are cutting them off from afar. We're cutting them off digitally. We're taking them out of systems. We're taking, you know, we're stopping supporting their software. We're doing things that are like, you know, very different than it used to be, because we're just so much more digitally connected. And obviously the digital connection begins at the hardware level with semiconductors. And if we're just like, I just can't get over the fact that, you know, people are, or rather like we're concerned about this. We're like, oh my God, we need to think more about this. We need to decouple, and the CHIPS Act hasn't been passed. That is literally the first step. That is the first step. It should have already been done. It should have been done yesterday. It should have been done like months ago. And the CHIPS Act doesn't even get us to where we need to be, right? Like, how long do you think it will realistically take to replicate Taiwan's manufacturing base? 10 years. And I don't think we'll be as good as Taiwan in 10 years. I think we could just have a substitute good, but not a, like, maybe even a complementary good, where it's like, okay, this is good enough for a nation to hold, you know, to supply themselves. I just can't believe, like, we need to be starting on this journey yesterday. And the CHIPS Act is something that has to have happened already for us to begin this journey. And we haven't even started. Like, what the fuck is going on? Like, this should have been passed already. I am so, like, every once in a while, I actually think about it, and it makes me, like, physically upset, because it's not even a bipartisan, like, it's a bipartisan supported issue. Like, everyone is like, oh, this is a good idea, yet it hasn't been passed. What's going on? Sorry, Dylan. Any thoughts on top of that? Because I just think it's a shame, a tragedy, really.
Yeah, I mean, you hit all the points on the head. And, you know, I could rant about how the CHIPS Act isn't even enough. But, you know, please pass it, and then we can rant about exactly why it isn't enough.
Yeah.
You know, because we don't want to delay this thing further.
It is a first step. It really is. Like, this is a long journey. Like, it really reminds me, okay, so maybe use China as the foil, right? They are like, oh, we're going to do Made in China 2025. They're not on track to do it, right? But at the same time, they're like, oh, we're going to make this long, arduous journey that's going to take a lot of capital to be able to be independently sourced for semiconductors by 2025. That's like long-term planning, and it's probably not enough. And whenever 2025 comes around, they're like, okay, we're going to do even more by 2035, right? Another 10-year plan. That is the kind of time frame and length that we need to be planning about and thinking. And I just think it's like maybe not possible with the current political structure, but like the CHIPS Act, it like has to happen for us to even begin this journey, right? Like, obviously not. We've already begun this journey partially, but to really like strengthen, give us the ability to have staying power, to be able to really do this for a long period of time. Because Taiwan has subsidies that makes about 35% or like 30% more cheaper to make a fab there. And we just don't have that. Like, we need the CHIPS Act yesterday. Come on, guys, pass this. Like, if anyone who's listening to this that has like any kind of sway or whatever, please just tell them, like, let's cut the pork. Like, just get it funded. I believe it's passed partially, but like, it needs the funding. That's really what's important now. Okay,
so call your senator. Call your senator.
Yeah, I actually have. I already sent an email. I probably should call them. Dude, maybe this is what we need to be doing on Twitter. We need to just have like a call your senator campaign on Twitter for the CHIPS Act.
I'm down. Yeah. And House Rep. Yeah. And
Let's do it. Okay. Okay, cool. Well, I think we're going to end it there. Please call your senator and your House Rep. And you know what? I encourage you to, you know, tell your friends to do that too, because the CHIPS Act is extremely important. And I think this is a good ending for the podcast.
Yep, definitely. If you care about technology, which anyone listening to this does, you have the same belief that supply chain issues being concentrated, you know, so much is a bad thing, and you know, wherever you're from, whatever country it's from, needs to be involved in the supply chain, whether it's not yet and it's getting into it, like in India, or it's you know, you're in it but you're losing a lot of dominance, like a Europe or US.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's just important. Anyways, thanks for listening. I hope this this conversation about geopolitics, the economy, and decoupling was helpful. I'm looking forward to what's next. And yeah, we'll see you in a few weeks. Cool.
See ya. Bye.
Bye.